Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. This week on Lunchbox MV, the Aztecs like to mash them up and smear them on roasted grasshoppers.
It takes about 500 of them to make one jar of spread.
And in the early 20th century, it was thought rubbing it into your scalp cured baldness. Spoiler alert, bald men everywhere, it does not. This week, it's peanuts. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie, I'm a chef and food writer, and I'm here with my sweet QI elves, Jack and Manu.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
Hello.
How's it going?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent.
Nice. So, peanuts. Let's take the temperature of the room, I think. How do we feel about peanuts?
I like legit am scared of having a kid with a peanut allergy.
Really?
No shade. I would find it so hard to give them up.
Interestingly, you can develop them at any stage in your life.
No.
Yeah. Mm. So it's not a matter of if you're born with it, then you're stuck. But if you're born without it, then you're not.
Now I just have the L'Oreal advert in my head.
Maybe you're born with it.
That's
maybe
Maybelline.
It's a peanut allergy. they are very much like prevalent. So like the comparison I would make is that like I use parsley as a herb the most. Similarly in cooking, I use peanuts probably the most out of all the different nuts.
Yeah.
Oh, are they a nut?
Ooh.
I'm not sure. I haven't quite decided. But they're very, very functional, useful, and extremely popular
as
a nut.
Aren't they mostly functional because of their oil content? Basically, they're like 50% oil, right?
50% fat.
Why they're so tasty.
It is indeed why they're so tasty. But it also means that they can function in cookery, for example, as a very useful fat, both as an oil. Peanut oil has a very high smoking point, so you can fry in it. But also, you know, for example, they are very good at blending down into a butter-like substance, which we will come to.
Yeah.
I'm sure we're going to discuss.
Being very evasive.
Well, I don't want to give the game away too soon, right?
You're also being evasive when you call them a nut.
Well, that's a good reason, Manu, because in the true style of this podcast and generally QI Productions, they are not a nut.
Oh, okay. What are they then?
They are, in fact, a legume.
Okay.
A type of pea.
Like a chickpea or something.
Pea nut. There's like a pea-esque nut.
Oh, they should be nut peas then, in my mind.
Oh, a nut pea.
Not pea, but they are peas.
And so legume is like a pulse?
It's a pulse, yeah. Okay. So same family as beans, lentils, and chickpeas. And famously, they're grown underground.
Oh.
So unlike tree nuts, which you grow on trees, you know, you understand that.
Got it. Thanks, Rosie.
I'm sure that
makes
sense to you all. Almonds, walnuts are types of tree nuts. And when you harvest them, you pull out the plants from the soil so that on the plant, the peanuts look like little bunches of onions.
Wow. Or potatoes, I was thinking. Yeah. So,
yeah.
And that's why they're known as ground nuts, I guess, in some places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are a couple of other names. Goober.
This is, the Americans love calling them a goober pea. It sounds
really?
Like a booger.
Yeah, I've never come across it. This.
But it comes from a West African word, nguba.
Oh.
Brought to the Americas via the transatlantic slave trade. And monkey nut, which is still used in some parts of the UK. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've heard monkey nuts. They're the ones in the shell, right?
I think if you said, would you like a monkey nut? I'd be like, what's that?
They take so long to shell.
Yeah, they do. They do.
Peanuts also have a really beautiful flower.
Do they?
I had no idea.
What color?
Yellow.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. They're really pretty. They look kind of like, you know, sweet peas have really pretty flowers.
Yeah.
A little bit similar to that. It's kind of orchidy yellow.
Oh, beautiful. I bet I would love those. Do they smell nice? Write in if you've ever smelled a peanut flower. We'd love to know what it smells like.
Yeah.
But where did peanuts come from?
Not West Africa, apparently.
Oh.
So we've traced them back to the Incas and Aztecs. So Central South America, they've been cultivated for 3,500 years. Many Mesoamerican cultures have depictions of peanuts, sort of carved into temples or stone things.
Yeah, because stone walls and pictures.
But they know what's up. Like all of the best foods are carved into stuff. Like,
absolutely.
Historical.
So they were probably revered, I imagine.
Yeah, because yeah, they're delicious. That really good ancient Five Guys carving. I love going there.
So we mentioned in the intro that Aztecs used to make a sort of rudimentary peanut butter and then smear them over grasshoppers, which I love as an idea. But apparently they're full of protein and umami. Mm-hmm. I mean, peanuts themselves are full of protein.
Functionally, it sounds quite hard to have to spread. Well, I can only imagine it'd be quite thick peanut butter on a very small, fragile, fried, roasted, dried grasshopper. Like
in tropical countries, grasshoppers can get pretty big.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, you're right.
But they used to mix them with honey, which I find fascinating. This same dish is basically grasshoppers, peanut butter and honey, which is basically the sort of salty, sweet kick that we get from a PBJ sandwich.
Yeah.
Has anyone tried grasshoppers?
No, I still haven't. I'm working myself up to it. Maybe 2027.
Okay. I take it.
Give yourself 2 years rather than just one.
I just think I get a bit distance from how I feel about it right now.
I did spend some time in the Kruger National Park in South Africa. And that's where I had, weirdly, they sold these things as stink bugs, which doesn't sound like the most appealing insect to try, but it was pretty disgusting. I will say, like, I think entophagy, as it's known, eating insects is probably the future. Or at least we shouldn't be squeamish about it.
No, you're right. I mean, there's definitely a movement to eat them more. They're much more, as I understand it, there's a few different insect breeds which are much more eco to eat than a lot of other protein sources. Mm-hmm. And there are definitely Mexican restaurants in London now. I can't name them off the top of my head, but they're serving grasshoppers.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe we should go on a group outing.
Yeah.
I love it.
But again, I did say in 2027, so yes, just true. Okay. Shall we dive into our first lunchbox, ladies and gents?
Oh, yes.
Yes, please.
What I've brought for you today is a dish that I first tried maybe 4 or 5 years ago. That is called granat soup.
Oh,
wow.
Look at that.
That looks fierce.
To describe it for the listener, it is a thick stew in chicken. I will talk about why I've used chicken a little bit later. Made from peanut butter.
Oh.
And this recipe that I followed is a Sierra Leonean recipe.
Okay.
I found out about this dish because a few years ago when I was a home economist on television shows, making food for chefs on camera, I worked with a chef rapper called Big Zoo. Oh, Big Zoo is from Sierra Leone.
Cool.
And he introduced me to this dish, granat soup, and it is divine. Yeah. It's like all good peanut butter stuff. It's super savory, extremely rich, Moorish, delicious, decadent. Umami, mm-hmm. decadent.
Sierra Leone, roundest country in the world.
Serious?
Really?
Yeah.
That's such a weird fact.
It's closest to the circle. Yeah.
This is an extremely common recipe that is used all over West Africa.
Mm.
Granat is a derivation of the word groundnut in Sierra Leonean dialect. But there are literally, like, I cannot describe to you, like, hundreds of different versions of this across West Africa.
Yeah.
In Sierra Leone, as I said, it's granat soup or granat stew. Uh-huh. In Cameroon and Senegal, it's called mafe. In Gambia, it's called domoda. In Nigeria, it's called omutsagwe. As you can see, it's popular.
Lots of variations.
And there's lots of variations, and they all have, you know, in all the best regional food, everything differs town by town, right? It's the same with this. There are lots of different versions. I could not find, like, a consistent recipe. For want of a better word, it's a kitchen sinker. You can kind of put anything in it, but the main ingredient is groundnut paste, which brings me on to sort of, like, why West Africa? Why is this such an important part of West African food culture? And it's because in the 1600s, the Portuguese were colonizing Africa and they brought over peanuts from South America, because we know that they didn't grow in West Africa before. But then in the 1840s, the world was constantly looking for new types of fuel, oil seeds, basically.
Wait, sorry, is this fuel for like vehicles?
So, not fuel for vehicles, but it's cooking oil, soap, and lamps. They did peanut oil could be used for fuel lamps.
Okay, nice.
So basically, the export of peanuts started from West Africa by the French, who were at that point colonizing that part of the world.
As well as the
Portuguese had been gone, the French are in now. To sort of summarize a very complicated part of history, the French had abolished slavery in France and were talking a big game about not, you know, being abolitionists and stuff. But when they were working out in Africa and they realized that this crop was very prevalent, it's very easy to grow, they needed slavery to be able to export it. So they kind of did what most of these colonizing, enslaving countries did. They basically pretended that they were liberating and civilizing, as has been the rhetoric for a lot of these different, you know, the Belgians, the English, mm-hmm. they pretended they were going to Africa and doing a really good thing, but they actually weren't. They were exploiting and enslaving. It was described as the peanut boom.
Okay,
so it was so popular that by 1871, France was importing 17,000 tons of peanuts annually. And then by 1880, it was 55,000 tons.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's how big it was. So anyway, so that's why peanuts became this incredibly important food in West Africa and has become, you know, extremely culturally prevalent in cuisines across that region. I've made this Tazou's recipe. There are a few consistent ingredients across the various versions of this dish from West Africa. I would say those are onions, bell peppers, tomato paste is very often used, scotch bonnet, chili peppers. They are in pretty much every version I could find.
Delicious.
Extremely spicy.
Yeah.
To be fair, then it's not that spicy because what obviously tempers all of those ingredients is the peanut butter, the ground nut paste. For my version, I did use peanut butter because that's what I could get hold of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A whole ginormous
There's
jar.
A whole jar of peanut.
Really?
Yeah, you need to go hard on the peanut butter.
It's not that thick. It's not like when you have peanut butter raw, it goes to the roof of your mouth. And
like, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think because there is also liquid in there from the cooking of the meat. Like, it's diluted. Yeah. In West Africa, you would use ground nut paste, which is slightly different consistency. It's a lot thinner. Anyway, should we try some?
Let's do it. It smells incredible. Mm. I really want to use my hands. I'm hands in it. Oh, my God. Whoa.
Oh, I feel like West African Henry VIII with my drumstick.
Oh, you guys did go hands in.
Mm-hmm.
If you're wondering what you would serve it with, you can serve it with rice, obviously. White rice, perfect. But often it would be found also with pounded yam, boiled cassava, fufu, which is a type of boiled starch. So you'd either make it with cassava, yam, or plantain. Fonio, banku, and kenkey.
Oh.
All of which look quite similar.
What's a kenkey?
Kenkey is basically maize that's been steeped in water for a week or so, sort of almost fermented. Then it's milled and kneaded with water into a kind of dough.
Okay.
And then that's fermented and then it's cooked, steamed.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Oh, shout out to Big Z.
Yeah, he is a lovely man. Mm. Really nice.
I knew.
But a very happy time working for him.
Oh, thank you, Rosie.
Delicious.
My pleasure. We all got to have some granat soup.
Are you going
to
take the leftovers home?
You look like you'd like them.
You have first dibs. You made it.
Okay.
Shall we talk a bit more about peanut butter and its origins?
Yeah, I'd love to know more.
So,
sorry.
Sarcastic Rosie.
Wow.
So to thank for our modern peanut butter, the way we jar it and mix it with oil and make it delicious and spreadable, we have none other than John Harvey Kellogg. Heard of him?
I'm assuming he is of Kellogg fame.
Yes, he is.
Crunchy nut. No, wait.
Wait, what?
It's great. is that from Kellogg's?
That's the Frosties.
The Frosties. They're a type of Kellogg's.
So, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, he was a doctor, and in 1895, he was running this, he called it a sanatorium. We would basically call it a wellness center nowadays, and it was in Battle Creek, Michigan, and he believed in what we would now call wellness, I think. He was basically into integrative health, and he thought the diet was a huge part of it. He was very much after clean living. He was a strict vegetarian. He promoted yogurt enemas.
Oh.
You thought they were good for you. Anyway, that's beside the point. Save that for the yogurt episode. And he was promoting healthy, clean living, basically. And he was famous for the cereal. He actually developed breakfast cereal as he thought that a bland, nutritional way to start the day was a way to avoid like all these sort of hot feelings and to stop people masturbating, basically, because he was very anti-masturbation.
Oh. I mean, that feels antithetical to wellness. Yeah. Masturbation surely is highly important to one's wellness.
Back in the day,
The temptations of the flesh were considered to be.
Have you seen the little like anti-masturbatory kind of Victorian style
like a chastity belt?
No, but for penises.
Oh no,
I haven't. They look like, you know, the egg cutters.
Oh, no, God.
But you just wear them and it's like, oh, don't get excited. Don't
like
get
a nutcracker.
Excited. Yeah, exactly. It's mad. Literally. They hated masturbation.
Yeah.
Crazy, because anyway. They were horny buggers.
I know. Mm. Well, it's that also runs antithetical to the yoga enemas, which might actually encourage you to masturbate.
I mean, yoga enema doesn't sound that bad to me. No. I just think something creamy and cold going up your bum maybe would be nice. I don't mean it like that. Also, that's quite clever, because was he doing a yoga enema by virtue of good bacteria going back into your... Yeah, so that's clever.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Axmel.
He was onto something.
Can I just say, do not, if you're listening to this...
Yes, we don't
condone
it.
Do not try at home.
No.
Yes. Or do try. Let us know how it is.
Oh, there are lots of other podcasts where you could find some information on how to try that. But not this one.
Anyway, so Kellogg was into all this wellness stuff. One of the things he identified is that peanut butter was a really useful source of nutrition for people who couldn't chew. So he would grind peanuts down. It was much coarser and less tasty than we have modern peanut butter today, not least because he was into bland foods. But yeah, he's kind of credited with popularizing peanut butter.
Sorry, I just have such a strong image of Kellogg just smushing peanut butter into people's face.
And up their bottoms.
Oh, God, Rosie. So I was looking at expensive peanut butters. Mm. And I remembered something that we looked up for QI, actually. And it's to do with standard reference materials. In the world of manufacturing, so if you're making like the perfect version of something, or you want like a product to be exactly the same every time so you can run like a standard number of tests on it.
Okay, consistency.
You need materials that have the exact same qualities, like say the same amount of salt or like iron or any kind of mineral or chemical that will not change throughout your test. So in the US, they have the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, which makes these standard reference materials. So they have like a standard cigarette. So you know when you have like, you order a piece of furniture and it has that label and it's like, this is highly flame retardant or highly flammable. They will have tested that using a cigarette from one of these companies.
Goodness.
Wow.
So they are also... really expensive.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So a jar of peanut butter from the National Institute in the US would cost you just under £360.
Oh my God.
What?
I know.
So sorry if I'm being thick here, but what do we use the standard reference peanut butter example for? What is it used for?
Oh, Rosie, have you ever come across a mystery substance and wondered... is this peanut butter?
Because I'm not an idiot.
Well, you'd think that were the case, but apparently you use standard reference peanut butter and other standard reference materials for testing mystery substances. So if you've got something, you can be like, let's just see if the chemical components are the same as the standard reference peanut butter.
Right. So I guess it's kind of like similar to DNA testing, but for food things.
That's a really good analogy.
Right. So, for example, if a supermarket is using peanut butter as an ingredient in a smoothie, they can approximate the calories and the nutritional value of said smoothie with the standard reference peanut butter, because that basically is their benchmark. That is actually a useful thing, I suppose. Because I was like, the sofa companies surely can't be using this peanut butter for jet staining.
No, but they're not. It's just there when they need it.
Yeah, it's there when they need
That's the thing. It's the control peanut butter.
Yeah. Mm, exactly. It's also really good if you want to like quality control. If you're creating government regulations about what constitutes a certain food, you can use the standard reference peanut butter. And if you want to test, there's no like rogue or random elements or ingredients in your peanut butter, say a beetle got in your batch or something, you can test against the standard reference.
But then you can just like brand it as an Aztec snack then, can't you? Like yeah. This peanut contains locusts.
Well, it's time for our second lunchbox, and that is you, Mr. Jack. Would you please indulge us?
I've brought you all a Snickers bar each.
Hey!
Yummy! Oh.
But I've also made some from scratch, which are missing a key ingredient, and I wonder if you can tell me what that is.
Wow, those are amazing, Jack. Even I wouldn't be bothered to do that.
They are beautiful.
Well, truth be told, I couldn't be bothered to do that either. So our producer, Alex, has made them.
Oh, really?
And
oh,
he congrats. Said that I Thank could claim you, credit for them.
Those
so
are beautiful. And I know you can't cook, so.
Oh, shot fired.
Okay, so I'm gonna take them up. Right, come on.
I'm going to do the OG in the wrapper Snickers bar first.
For those of you who don't know what a Snickers bar is, it's a chocolate bar filled with nougat, caramel, and peanuts.
Whoa. I'm going to go in for... Oh my God, that's fudgy.
It's way more sugary.
I'm picking up the homemade one.
Yeah, the homemade one is my next bite.
It breaks so beautifully.
Mm.
Thank you, Alex.
Mm.
That is fucked up, man.
In a good way?
Yeah, in a good way.
Oh,
that's so good.
It's so good.
Mm.
So Snickers, one of the most... I would say one of the most, I mean, it's the most eaten chocolate bar. It's got to be one of the most famous peanut-based confectionery out there. It was invented in 1930 by Mars Incorporated.
Not so, by Dr. Snickers.
No, not by, there's no such human as Dr. Snickers, as far as my research has led me. The Mars family had a favorite horse, which was called Snickers.
Sorry, racehorse.
A racehorse, yeah.
Right, okay.
So it was launched in 1930, but only in America, and it arrived in Britain in 1968. Only they thought that Snickers would sound a bit too much like knickers, and that's rude. So they changed it to Marathon, which basically anyone over the age of 40 is quite keen to tell you. You used to be called Marathon, you know, and they all sort of resent the day that it changed back to Snickers, which was in 1990. So kind of before our time, I think. But actually, there was, interestingly, a Marathon bar in America in the 70s. And it was basically what we would call a Curly Whirly.
Ooh. Oh.
So the whole...
Curly Whirly's a much better name than Marathon. Marathon's such a boring name. Snickers and Curly Whirly. Mm.
Wasn't it designed to like invoke the kind of slightly healthy, you know, gives your energy a boost? But have you had a chance to consider what the missing ingredient might be?
I think it's salt. So.
Well, I mean, technically it's salt. So there are two missing ingredients. But basically, it's a thing called reworking. And it happens in all sorts of manufacturing processes. Sometimes the process will go wrong and you'll get a whole batch, which is a bit misformed, so it can't be sold. But it's perfectly edible and they don't want to waste this perfectly good material. And so what they do is they'll throw it back into the mix of the next batch. So... essentially, every Snickers you eat has a bit of Snickers from an older batch, just the one before.
It reminds me of, in Chinese cookery, how they use master stocks.
So yes, perpetual soup.
Perpetual soup that they always keep creating and using the same stock and growing more stock. And also even a kind of similar to like wok hei, where they never clean the wok. Like the seasoning of the food comes from the seasoning of the wok and the constant use of the wok. And it's a similar principle.
Like I think Kit Kats are made similarly.
I think so too. I was going to say that the wafer.
Yeah, like the bit in between, that's old Kit Kats as well.
Another thing, when you're trying your branded chocolate bars, you should try eating them upside down because it often gives a very different flavor. If you look at the Snickers, it's got like the nuts are all on the top as you would normally eat it. And the nougat's on the bottom. But if you eat it upside down, it gives you a whole different mouthfeel.
I'm like bubbling to say this. Do you guys eat Pringles upside down?
What is there an upside down? I feel like they're symmetrically...
They're not. No,
maybe they're not.
They're like the horse saddle shape, but all of the flavoring and the MSG is on the top. So you know how they come stacked in the tube and like the two sides are going down and you got one kind of bit in the middle? That's where all of the salt is. You eat them upside down, boosh, straight on your tongue. Amazing.
Jesus Christ, they should promote that, to be honest, because like we're all missing out on the ultimate Pringles.
Yeah, but I think there'll be someone out there who's like, wait, there's no seasoning on the other side? What is this?
Have you guys heard of George Washington Carver? He's arguably the patron saint of domesticated peanuts, certainly in America.
No, I haven't.
I think Americans, he's a bit of a household name in America. I think a lot of people think he invented peanut butter, which isn't quite true, but he certainly popularized the peanut as a useful crop, especially in the American South. So he was actually born into slavery. He was born just before emancipation in around 1864, we're not really sure. And he was a scientist, inventor, agricultural educator. He was a very clever man. He became one of the most influential black scientists in U.S. history. And he was revered in his later years for he wanted to diversify from cotton because the monoculture in the South was creating really poor soils. So he was like, why don't we grow peanuts and sweet potatoes? So all sorts of legumes that bring the nitrogen back into the soil. Mm-hmm. And he developed like hundreds of products to do with peanuts in order to, you know, make a commercial reason to grow peanuts. So,
gosh.
Yeah.
Clever man.
Yeah.
We're going on to our final lunchbox of the day, and that is from Manu.
Thank you, Rosie. So I have bought potentially my favourite drink and food combination, peanuts and beer.
Nutritious.
It's great. anyway, so this is something that I read about. It's a party trick that they do in Argentina where they'll have a beer, and they put their peanuts in it at the bar and they watch them dance.
Dance?
What?
I know, they're dancing. So here's one I made earlier.
Ooh.
Oh. I'm going to pop it on there.
It looks freaky deaky, like something from, an episode of American Horror Story.
They're going up and
it
down,
looks
though.
Very unappetizing. The peanuts have kind of become a bit swollen the lager. I bought these two things here today to do the experiment, and we poured it just to test, and they did nothing. And we were all...
They were just floating on the top.
It was so scary. So, and I was like, what have I done? So
we were
left...
ready to fire, Manny. We handed her a P45.
Yeah, no, it was great. Great fun. I was shitting myself. And then after about half an hour or so, an hour, they started dancing. So the peanuts are floating to the top of the beer. They'll chill out there for a little bit and then they'll sink down to the bottom and then float back up. It looks very much like a lava lamp.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Natural lava. Great fun. In 2013, researchers figured out why this happens. And it's basically the peanuts are denser than the beer. So when you put...
It's really hypnotic.
Yeah, my girls are staring.
It is lava lamp, isn't it? So the peanuts are denser than the beer. So when you put them in, they should sink to the bottom. When they're in the bottom, all of the little bubbles collect and they're attracted to the peanut. So they stick to the peanut and then eventually they make the peanut buoyant enough for them to rise to the top of the beer. And then when it gets to the surface, the bubbles on the top near the very surface of the beer come off peanut, and then it does this really cool flippy thing because now there are more bubbles attached to the bottom of the peanut. They turn over, the bubbles burst off the other side of the peanut, and then it sinks back down. So they think that this kind of process is going to help researchers in the future.
Wait, this has a use?
It does. It's actually scientifically useful. They hope that it's going to help scientists figure out like magma flows. So, you know, the kind of lava lamp style movement,
Literally.
But in actual geography and geology.
Crazy.
She's mad.
Is there a reason why it's peanuts other than other nuts? Like, does it work with other nuts?
Well, I bet they're the right density.
Yeah, if they're the right density, they should.
Oh, it just moved dramatically. Maybe it's my arm.
Ooh.
It feels like this would be a great cheat if your kid is like, please have a lava lamp. Please, please, please. You'd be like, no, I know what I can give you.
We've got a lava lamp at home.
I used to have a lava lamp. Did you guys have a lava lamp?
I grew up with one.
That was sick 90s culture.
Oh, yeah.
I feel deprived now.
You're a bit young, Manny.
Well, you've got one right here, babe. Yeah. Just made it.
Damn. Yeah, I'll take it. Do you want to try some, Jack?
We'll sip it.
Yeah, I want to try it. Also, because another reason peanuts and beer go so well together is because the saltiness of the peanuts can help kind of cancel out bitterness in lager.
Mm.
And similarly, the saltiness makes you like enjoy the kind of refreshingness of the beer.
Yeah.
So it's like, a balance made in heaven.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mm. So that is the peanut and beer lava lamp. Thank you very much.
The dancing nuts. Goobers. The dancing goober. Great pub name.
That is a great pub name.
Yeah.
Whilst we're on peanutty chemicals and science and chemical reactions, we haven't spoken that much about peanut allergies.
Yes.
As I said, I can't imagine having one because I love peanuts so much. Yeah. So it's basically just your body getting a little bit very confused about threats. So it will think that the peanut protein is trying to attack you, kind of like an infection, and then it will start reacting to it like it's under attack.
What allergies are, it's your own body attacking you.
Exactly.
That's such a shame.
Yeah. Peanut allergies are actually becoming more common because my parents always talk about, kids never had allergies back in the day. And I'm like, surely there aren't more because that doesn't make sense. But there are actually. So before the 1990s, peanut allergies were actually quite rare. Mm. But cases in the US and the UK have tripled since then, which is bonkers. And we're not entirely sure why this is the case, but there are a couple of ideas. And one is to do with the fact that we are way too clean now, especially post-pandemic. Mm. We love cleaning surfaces. We love washing our hands, as we were told to do so frequently, which is really important. But your body is exposed to less actual pathogens. But it's still like, I got to do something.
Yeah.
And then it turns on peanuts.
There is one trial that they've done to try and reduce and cure peanut allergies, actually. It's to do with exposure therapy. So in 2023, scientists trialed a toothpaste which contained very tiny amounts of peanut, you know, about a milligram. They did a study, and by the end of the 48-week trial, they managed to eat like a third of a peanut each.
Ooh.
And not have a reaction.
I'd take that. Yeah. That's pretty good.
Yeah. It's just a long,
it's a long way
to go.
It's a long process. Yeah, true.
To eat a quarter of a peanut. You'd have to do about 4 years before you could eat like one spoon of peanut butter.
God, it's worth it though.
Worth it for your peanut dish.
Well, that's right. Just wanted to tell you something that I found out is that the creator of peanut M&Ms is a man called Forrest Mars from the Mars family.
The same family.
Yeah. He was allergic to peanuts. How he got that product made, I do not know. That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
We'll also be posting up any recipes we've mentioned on the website. Just head to qi.com/lunchbox to check them out.
Rosie, do you have any other parting gifts of peanut recipes that aren't Big Zoos?
Yes, fair enough. Well, actually, I don't know if you've ever tried ice cream with peanut butter, specifically pip and nut, and chili oil on it.
Wow.
It's really good.
I have not.
A dollop of peanut butter on vanilla ice cream with a little trickle of chili oil on top of that. That is a savory, sweet sensation.
That sounds amazing.
Really highly recommend.
You're a maverick.
Love it.
And we'll leave you with this. Araki butyrophobia is the very real fear of getting peanut butter stuck to the roof of your mouth. I've been there. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Orio, and me, Rosie McKean. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee, and it was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.